So in order to do that, I want to talk a bit more about the nature of the Perfect Wisdom Sutras, of which the Heart Sutra is perhaps the most notable, or certainly at least the most well known. So the Perfect Wisdom Sutras, it is believed, are among the oldest of the Mahayana Buddhist Sutras. They actually represent some of the earliest strata of Mahayana Buddhist scriptures that evolved. But they did evolve over a very long period. Some of them grew even quite large. I think the largest one is The Perfection of Wisdom in 100,000 Lines, which is a kind of massive tome. I have to concede that I haven't read that one. Some of them are much shorter, like the Heart Sutra, which is just a couple of pages, and some of them are somewhere in between. Although it's sometimes said that these texts are very negative in their tone, like the passage that I read from the Heart Sutra, actually, many of them aren't like that. In fact, I was looking at the Diamond Sutra yesterday, because I think Jung was asking me about the Diamond Sutra last week, and I thought, well, I better have a look at it so that I've got something to say about that. And actually, the Diamond Sutra, when I was reading it anyway, read very much like many of the other Mahayana sutras that I was talking about last week. Although there are certain moments where it says something like, I think this is the Diamond Sutra, and if it's not, it should be. It says something like, the Bodhisattva saves all beings knowing that there are no beings to be saved. That kind of thing. Which is really quite paradoxical. And this kind of paradox, this idea that somehow the Bodhisattva is helping beings but at the same time is aware that there aren't really beings, is quite kind of characteristic of some of the Perfect Wisdom texts. And it's a way of talking that can be very confusing and even maybe quite misleading in some ways. You know, what can it mean to say that the Bodhisattva saves beings but there are no beings really? Anybody got any thoughts on that?
Well, both statements are true. The sentence, if you've got full stop in the middle, you've got two true statements stapled together, haven't you? In and of themselves, the Bodhisattva saves all beings is true. And then what's the second part about all beings?
There are no beings.
That's true because of the fundamental nature of everything.
Which is what?
What, emptiness?
Brilliant. Exactly. Fantastic.
There are no beings. There is only being.
I'm not sure that I fully understood that, but to come back to what you were saying, Adrian, so from an absolute point of view, there are no enduring independent beings, but that's not negating, and this is the important point, it's not negating the fact that we exist in a phenomenological sense, in the day-to-day sense that we ordinarily see it. We walk around, it's not like you are all figments of my imagination, or I'm a figment of yours, sadly. It's not like that. But sometimes it is understood that way, as though one day, if we understood things correctly, somehow everybody would vanish, and we'd just be, well, enveloped in some state of emptiness. It's not really like that. But as you very correctly said, what's being said is there are no beings that exist completely independently, because all things arise in dependence on conditions. So we're halfway there already, really. That's excellent. Yeah, one of the things that the Perfect Wisdom texts do, and the clue really is in the title, is they place a great deal of emphasis on wisdom. This is something that they very much value. And I'm always quite struck by the fact that it's often said that the nature or the distinctive characteristic of Mahayana Buddhism is that it emphasizes compassion. But I actually think it's probably more characteristic to say that it emphasizes wisdom. There's so much emphasis on wisdom in the Mahayana scriptures, even those that appear to talk a great deal about compassion. What's seen as fundamentally important is to realize wisdom, or in more technical terms, prajna. Prajna, that's seen as the goal, to realize wisdom. But what is that? What is wisdom? What is prajna? And it's actually maybe a more complex idea than might immediately seem. And it's an idea that I want to kind of move towards slowly to explore what it in fact does mean. On some levels, perhaps lower levels, it consists in ascending levels of conceptual understanding, ascending levels of grasping conceptually the nature of Buddhist ideas, the nature of Buddhist teachings. So for instance, the way that we're speaking about Shunyata right now is a conceptual way of speaking. To some extent, we've got some conceptual grasp on the basic Buddhist teachings. On one level, this is a certain kind of prajna, certain kind of wisdom or understanding. But actually, in Buddhist terms, prajna is also something quite a bit more technical. And it's actually a style of analysis, or a style of, you could almost say, it's a style of deconstruction. It's a kind of method of analysing any given phenomenon into its seeming constituent elements. Give you an example of that. So, again, in the first passage that I read out, whatever is form, that is emptiness. Whatever is emptiness, that is form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. So that list is a list of five elements known as the five skandhas. Skandha means heap or assemblage or something of that sort. And the five skandhas is a very simple way of analysing the human being into smaller constituent elements. And the aim of doing that, the aim of doing that kind of prajna type analysis, is to understand, is to recognise that there is no enduring soul. This is the Buddhist understanding. There is no enduring identity. There's nothing that can be called the self in any enduring sense. And so applying this analysis of five skandhas is a way to see into this, but perhaps not just in an intellectual way, but perhaps in the depths of our meditation. And in fact, some people meditate very thoroughly on analysing the self in terms of the five skandhas. So this style of analysis, this type of analysis of taking something and breaking it down into smaller parts, this is a kind of prajna type analysis. And this particular concern, this particular way of doing things, this way of proceeding, was very much the interest of a tradition that became known as Abhidharma. Abhidharma literally means higher dharma, although I think it's a matter of that's very much open to question whether it is really higher dharma, but it's very much an analytical type dharma, and it engages in a lot of this prajna type analysis that I've been talking about. So it might take the human mind and analyse it into different constituent parts, maybe even many different parts, perhaps all the different possible emotions or all the different thought processes that one could have. It might analyse it into that. And some of these traditions concluded that after a certain level of analysis, you kind of reached the end. You reached a fundamental level of constituent, which they called, or which are known as dharmas. So this is not to be confused with dharma, as in talking about dharma being a term for the truth or the teaching. This is a different use of the term to refer. Dharma literally means something like things or atoms, atomic constituents, something like that. So the way that the analysis might work is that someone would analyse, say, the human being into something perhaps more complex than the five skandhas, a more detailed structure. And they get to a point where they would think, well, actually, there's nothing smaller, there's no more basic level of analysis that could be done. And so these fundamental concepts, these fundamental constituents that we've arrived at, these were called dharmas, and they were seen as irreducible. They couldn't be further analysed. And in some traditions, they began to be seen almost as things that endured over time, that almost had some kind of self, some kind of enduring identity. And as we've already established, the basic Buddhist teaching tells us that there is no such thing. There are no such things. There are no things that have a fixed enduring identity. So we've got a conflict here between perhaps the basic Buddhist idea and then this philosophical tradition that's begun to emerge, that has begun to, at least in some cases, see these fundamental constituents as unchanging, as being the ultimate building blocks of life, of experience. And it's in response to this situation, it's in response to this, I would say, this philosophical mistake that the philosophy of Shunyata was responding, was trying to address. So if we're to understand the philosophy of Shunyata fully, I suggest, we need to understand it contextually. We need to understand it as a specific response to a philosophical mistake, rather than seeing it as some absolute way of talking about things, more seeing it as a strategy, an intervention, a concern to try and correct a mistake that had been made.